Before he was a best-selling author, Joseph Wambaugh was a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department. And that experience helped Wambaugh write about cops as real people. More than three decades later, he's still writing. And in the last of our Crime in the City series, NPR's Mandalit Del Barco explores Wambaugh's Los Angeles.
Joe Wambaugh is treated like a star when he visits the police station in the gritty Hollywood neighborhood he's immortalized. He's even invited to address the baby-faced officers during roll call.
These young people are not going to know who this old fart is, Dan.
Oh, they know who you are, sir.
Huh?
Sergeant Donovan Lyons assures him of his cult status within the LAPD. Hanging on the walls of the station are framed movie posters of Wambaugh's famous films.
Anybody see the movies? Oh, yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
Wambaugh jokes a bit, then offers some advice from his book, Hollywood Station.
There's a line in there that the sergeant, who I call the oracle in the book, says that's true. It's that doing good police work is the most fun you will ever have in your lives. I'll leave you with that. Good to meet you. Thanks.
Wambaugh, who's now 71, is the son of a police officer. He joined the LAPD in the early 1960s after a stint in the Marines. For 14 years, Wambaugh worked his way up from patrolman to detective sergeant at LA's Hollenbeck Station. When he wasn't on duty, he wrote two successful novels about the LAPD, The New Centurions and The Blue Knight, which were made into movies.
Freeze, man! Your head's coming off! Cool it! Out of my way!
Wambaugh was also still a cop when he wrote and produced The Onion Field, a best-selling book and movie. It's the true life story of two LAPD officers who were kidnapped and taken to an onion field outside Bakersfield, California by two suspected robbers. As the film depicts, one of the cops, Ian Campbell, was murdered. Decades later, Wambaugh stands outside the Hollywood Station, which features sidewalk stars like those on Hollywood Boulevard for movie legends. Only these memorialize Ian Campbell and other cops killed while on duty.
I was put on Earth to write The Onion Field. That's how I felt about it. It was such an emotional experience for me. I took a six-month leave of absence from the police department to write that book. I read 40,000 pages of court transcript. I interviewed about 63 people. And wrote the book in 3 months, went back to my detective table at Hollenbeck Station, and stayed a cop for another year.
Wambaugh's celebrity grew, and he was sometimes hounded for autographs from the people he put in handcuffs. He eventually quit his day job to write and to create, among other works, the hit 1970s TV series Police Story. With his realistic portrayals of cops, Wambaugh transformed the formerly clean-cut Joe Friday image of the LAPD.
Before I came along, Dragnet and Adam 12 were good public relations vehicles for the LAPD, but they didn't attempt ever to tell how the job acts on the cop. The cops in those stories were stick figures, right? There were no third dimension to them. We didn't know who they were and what they felt.
Instead, the cops in Joseph Wambaugh's books do have feelings and flaws, which he says almost got him fired by the police chief at the time. But the current chief, William Bratton, warmly embraces him, and Wambaugh's books are now must-reads at the police academy.
I like to think of myself as the younger, sexier homicide detective he referred to in the story.
Hollywood Detective Sergeant Vicki Bynum says it's difficult to get police officers to open up, but she's among the scores of cops Wambaugh has interviewed over the years to collect their stories, which he then fictionalizes.
Joe's thing is to take you out to dinner, and cocktails flow, and the stories start to flow also. And he's found, I think, that women are a lot more conversive than men. The guys, you know, they usually take a few more cocktails.
Wambaugh's Los Angeles is populated not only with complex cops, but also wannabe actors and drug-addicted tweakers, wealthy immigrants, gawking tourists, and colorful street thugs.
All of the bad guys, or bad women, in my stories are ordinary little criminals.
Take, for instance, characters from Wambaugh's latest books about Hollywood. Costume celebrity lookalikes greet tourists in front of the famed man's Chinese theater, and sometimes they get into scuffles. In one scene, Batman fights with Spider-Man, and Marilyn Monroe has to call 911.
Yeah, no, I mean, it happens all the time in Hollywood.
Hollywood Detective Brett Goodkin helped Wambaugh with his research.
You do get those calls, you know, suspects dressed as Bart Simpson, and you show up, and sure enough, there's a really angry, maybe high, Bart Simpson that wants to fight. The majority of these street performers have criminal histories, you know, and they get into little squabbles among themselves.
Other scenes in Wambaugh's new books take place at L.A.'s legendary farmer's market, where showbiz old-timers hang out every morning. The group includes actor-producer Paul Mazursky, artist Charles Bragg, and assorted comedians.
Here comes my good friend Edward G. Robinson.
Hey,
When Wambaugh visits, they rib him about how he portrayed them in his books.
He's the geezer. I'm a young stud. He's the geezer.
No, I'm the codger. Paul Mazursky's the geezer. I'm the codger.
Aren't they something?
You had to put them in the book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, if I hadn't used them, they'd never speak to me again. The only thing they're angry about, they all wanted to be named in the book. With their agent's name, phone number. Available dates.
For lunch, Wambaugh heads to East L.A. for some Mexican food. At the popular restaurant El Tepayac, he meets up with another old pal, Mike Diaz.
Abrazos! Mikey.
Look what I brought.
Inside, they sit with their backs to the wall in case of any trouble, an old cop habit. Then Wambaugh reminisces with Diaz, a recently retired Hollywood Station sergeant. Some of Diaz's stories will be in Wambaugh's next book, Hollywood Moon.
He's like our godfather. He's the one that brought us to the screen and let people know what police work was really like. We have problems. We have heartbreaks. We have divorces. You know, we have kids that run away. We have kids that use drugs. We're just like you.
I'm the padrino.
He's our godfather.
Wambaugh is now working with Sony Pictures to turn his Hollywood trilogy into a TV series. He says he plans to continue writing about the cops in Los Angeles.
Of course, because I'm an LAPD cop, now and forever.
Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
You can read an excerpt from Wambaugh's latest book, Hollywood Crows, at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos.
Ambivalence, self-delusion, fear. Henry Fleming feels them all. Fleming, or the youth, as he's called, is the fictional hero of Stephen Crane's classic novel, The Red Badge of Courage. More than a century ago, it was one of the first American novels to look at the psychological impact of combat. NPR's Elizabeth Blair spotlights Henry Fleming for our series, In Character.
When The Red Badge of Courage was first published in the 1890s, some Civil War veterans were amazed at how Henry Fleming seemed to feel almost exactly the way they did in battle. Michael Schaefer is an English professor at the University of Central Arkansas.
There are even stories of veterans of the Civil War writing into newspapers saying, oh, I'm so glad to see Steve Crane publishing this because he and I were in the same regiment and he's a good guy.
But they were mistaken. Stephen Crane wasn't even born when the Civil War ended. But Civil War veterans were still alive when he was writing, and it's almost certain that Crane talked to them about their experiences. In many ways, Henry Fleming is a typical raw recruit and a typical teenager. When he joins the Union Army, he's got big ideas of what glorious battles await him, and he's eager to impress his friends and a brown-haired girl he likes. But pretty quickly, he questions himself and his courage. In 1951, John Huston made a film version of Red Badge. Henry Fleming was played by Audie Murphy, who in real life was the most decorated U.S. combat soldier of World War II.
How do you know you won't run when the time comes?
Run? Me?
Well, plenty of good enough men who thought they was going to do great things before the fight, but when the time come, they skedaddle.
He's afraid of being afraid. So, you know, on the eve of battle, he's wondering, what am I going to do? Am I going to run? Am I going to stand and fight? Are my friends going to see that I'm a man, that I'm brave, or are they going to see that I'm a coward?
Stephen Crane most likely based Red Badge of Courage on one of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War in Chancellorsville, Virginia.
Oh, you look off to our left and right. You can't see 25 yards in either direction.
Walking through the thick, dense woods where the Battle of Chancellorsville took place, John Hennessy, a historian with the National Park Service, says the most intense fighting began on May 3rd, 1863.
And on that morning, about 6 hours of fighting, about 18,000 men would fall, killed and wounded. Now, if you do the math, that comes down to about one man every second.
The army, writes Stephen Crane, was helpless in the matted thickets. Henry's neck was quivering with nervous weakness. The muscles of his arms felt numb and bloodless. When Henry sees other soldiers running, he runs himself, like a rabbit. Crane's prose echoes real accounts of what happened at Chancellorsville. John Hennessy found a letter by a Union soldier watching his comrades run away.
He said the retreat was headlong. They had thrown away everything that was loose, guns, knapsacks, caps, and many had no coat or blouse. They were crazed and fought to escape as though the enemy were close to them. We were ordered to stop them, but we might as well have tried to stop a cyclone. They dived through our line regardless of our guns and bayonets.
Not only does Henry run, but he justifies his running in his head. He sees a squirrel and throws a pine cone at it. The squirrel runs away.
And Henry thinks, aha, if it's natural for the squirrel to run away, it must be natural for me to have run away as well.
Paul Sorrentino is a professor at Virginia Tech who's writing a biography of Stephen Crane. He says Henry Fleming is a complex character. He both pities and envies the other soldiers who stayed and fought. He feels guilty that he left, but superior that he made the natural decision to save himself.
With the story in which we have a boy whose thoughts are constantly going back and forth between clarity and vagueness about what is war all about? What does it mean to be brave? Did I do the right thing?
And even though Henry Fleming questions himself on what seems like every page of the Red Badge of Courage, he can't seem to set himself straight. While he's separated from his regiment, he comes across more soldiers fleeing. In a panic, one of them hits Henry on the head with the butt of his rifle. Later, Henry finds his regiment again.
Henry Fleming!
Yeah, it's me.
Well, well, old boy. By ginger, I'm glad to see you. I give you up for a goner. I thought you was dead, sure enough.
Well, I've had an awful time. I've been all over, way over on the right. I got separated from the regiment. Terrible fighting over there. And I got shot, too.
Got shot?
Yeah, I got shot in the head.
Poor boy was inventing all sorts of excuses for his own cowardice in the face of enemy fire.
That's Joe Galloway, co-author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. As a war correspondent in Vietnam, he was with the 7th Cavalry at the Ia Drang Valley when they were surrounded by 2,000 North Vietnamese soldiers. Galloway says there have been Henry Flemings in every war.
Korea is rife with instances of guys who shot themselves in the foot with their own rifle just so they could get out of combat. They were willing to do that or were willing to have a friend shoot them in the leg. Anything, because they were absolutely terrified.
By the end of the Red Badge of Courage, Henry Fleming is transformed from the scared youth who runs to someone outraged and hungry to fight. Stephen Crane writes that Henry lost sense of everything but his hate, his desire to smash into pulp the glittering smile of victory which he could feel upon the faces of his enemies. Park Service historian John Hennessy found this account from a real soldier who fought at Chancellorsville.
My two tent mates were wounded, and after that I acted like a madman. I was stronger than I had been before, and a kind of desperation seized me. I snatched a gun from the hands of a man who was shot through the head as he staggered and fell. At other times I would have been horror-struck and could not have moved, but at this time I jumped over dead men with as little feeling as I would over a log.
The Red Badge of Courage has been called a coming-of-age novel, but there's been debate about what Stephen Crane is saying about courage, heroism, and maturity. At the end, Crane no longer calls Henry Fleming the youth, but rather a man. Joe Galloway isn't sure that's true.
I'm not sure what war really makes you except sad. I don't know that it makes you a man or that the army is the way to make yourself a man. That's an awful high price to pay. There's a very steep learning curve in combat.
Stephen Crane brought his fictional Henry Fleming back to life in a later work called The Veteran. Now an old man, Henry admits that he ran and that he was afraid. I thought the sky was falling down. I thought the world was coming to an end. You bet I was scared. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Stephen Carter is an accomplished Yale Law School professor and novelist. His series of bestsellers probe hot-button issues, political corruption, class warfare, racial tension, middle-class angst. Carter's latest is a sprawling and complicated tale called Palace Council. It centers on an ambitious writer named Eddie Wesley. He spends 3 decades trying to solve a murder, find his missing sister, crack a secret society, and win back a beauty named Aurelia Treen. Stephen Carter dropped by to explain his book, and he said it's many, many things.
It's a thriller, it's a conspiracy story. It's also a love story. It's also a bit of historical fiction because Richard Nixon and Langston Hughes and the Kennedys and a variety of other people play not just cameo roles, but play important roles in the story as the story goes on.
The very word thriller suggests movement, action, heightened pulse. So how do you create that kind of momentum on the page?
I think that's one of the reasons that so many lawyers, when they turn to writing fiction, write thrillers. Because if you think about it, what does everybody hate about a lawyer? There's a lot of things. But nevertheless, this is what people hate about lawyers. You go to a lawyer, you've come into some money, you want to rewrite your will. You go to the lawyer, you say, I want to rewrite my will. And the lawyer starts saying, have you thought about this, over and over, one question after another, that drives you nuts. The real skill that lawyers have that other people don't, it is thinking about contingencies. What if this happened? What if this happened? That's what lawyers are trained to do. So when a lawyer sits down to write a novel, it should be no surprise that the lawyer at the end of every chapter is thinking of some outlandish turn in the plot. It's what lawyers do naturally. So that, I think, is why so many lawyers are drawn to writing thrillers.
Who came to you first? Is it Eddie or Aurelia or
the
someone
truth
else?
Is, the first character who came to me about Palace Council, there were two. One of them is a real person, one of them who isn't. The one who's not a real person is a woman named Mona Vesey. In my previous novel, New England White, was told in the point of view of a young woman named Julia Carlyle. She had this domineering mother who'd been this professor for many years whose name was Mona Vesey. I became interested in what was Mona Vesey's life like that had turned her into this domineering, scary woman. In order to write about her life, I had to write about the 50s and 60s. And then I wanted to write about Nixon. Although I think of the 60s in many ways as the era of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, as we should, it was also the era of Nixon, who was one of the most fascinating and enigmatic and in many ways scary figures in American political history. I think he really was the dominant political figure of the 50s and 60s. He embodied something about America, but something that's scary about America, and that is that we love winners. We don't ask how they won unless somebody, usually a journalist, rubs our nose in it. Then we say, we had no idea he was taking steroids or whatever the other thing might have been. And then we turn in a fury on this person, but we don't ask. We don't inquire how people win. We love that they win. And Nixon was a guy who knew how to win. He embodied that scary aspect of America.
Why this period of history? You mentioned a certain interest or fascination with Richard Nixon. Was it that drove you, or were you interested in placing a story in this period of time? Was it Nixon or Mona Vesey or just a fascination with the 50s and 60s?
I think that's a great question, and I think you have to understand the 1960s to understand modern America. So many of the battles we still fight today, we were fighting then. All sorts of traditional understandings about the role of women, about the role of black people, a lot of different things were overturned at that time. And there was something else that happened in the 60s. There's something we take as a given in politics that Nixon actually invented, and that's the idea that politics, especially for national elections, divided between these hardworking middle-class traditionalists on this side and these scary liberals on the other side. That was a new way of dividing the electorate in 1968 when Nixon mapped it out. And every year, the candidates, the media, everybody takes that as the starting point. That was Nixon's invention as a way of breaking up the Democratic Solid South, but it was a new kind of politics. That's one of the many, many ways which the 1960s foreshadow the current era.
What role does racial tension play in the novels you write? If it's a color, an additional color in your palette as a novelist, is it a bright primary or a subtle pastel?
I write first trying to entertain. I try to write thrillers and page-turners. But if characters have race, and in so many books they don't, there's a default in American fiction that the characters are white and we don't talk about it. But if characters have a race, race is going to be a part of their lives. I liked your vision of a pastel. That is, I mean it as a light touch, but the touch is always there. So I want the reader to become lost in the story, but at the same time to every now and then notice those light brushstrokes where I try to illuminate a little piece of the issue of race in America without ever wanting to write a message book. I'm not trying to teach or hit the reader over the head. I'm trying to write an entertainment, but I have a few light brushstrokes in there, and I suppose I always will.
How do you write dialogue?
How? I don't know.
Do you talk aloud when you do it?
I sometimes talk aloud. My wife peeks her head into my study and says, "Are you here alone?" She worries I talk to myself too much. But I can hear the words in my head, and I often read the dialogue to my wife. My wife reads all my drafts anyway, but I often read the dialogue parts to her. Does this sound like a real conversation, I might ask. But a lot of my writing is agony, the truth is. When I write nonfiction, I've written 7 nonfiction books, it's hard work, but I know how to do it. When I spend a day, all day long, writing nonfiction, at the end I'm tired, but I'm perfectly happy. When I spend a day writing fiction, I am utterly drained, utterly exhausted. It's as though I get so involved, not with the story, but with the characters, that I'm feeling their aches and pains. I don't know how else to describe it. The act of creation is so different and sometimes painful, but I tend to be happy with the result.
Stephen Carter, thanks so much for coming in.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Carter's latest book is called Palace Council.
Foraging has always been an option for humans in need of food. Meadows, woods, and riverbeds can provide a harvest of nuts, fruits, berries, and greens if you know what to look for. The great outdoors is also full of both medicinal herbs and poisons. Christina Meldrum used both the art and science of foraging as threads in her debut novel, Mad Apple. Mad Apple is another term for Jimson weed, a poisonous plant with psychotropic characteristics. It figures heavily in the relationship between a daughter and her mother, who at the beginning of the book live only on what they can forage. Christina Meldrum joins us from the studios of WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How much did you know about botany when you began to write this book?
You know, I knew very little about botany, actually. I had been a comparative religion major, and then I had gone to law school. And when I started writing the book, I realized that Aslaug, the protagonist, and her mother, Marin, really would need to live off the land. They needed to be very isolated from modern society. And so I realized that Aslaug in particular would view the world through the lens of plants, and that I would really need to be able to do that in order to get inside of her head. So I spent about a year or so, maybe even more, focusing specifically on studying the plants that were indigenous to Maine.
Tell us a little bit more about her mother. She strikes me as being one of these almost medieval women who is very easily dismissed by society as a quote-unquote witch. But she also is a great believer in not only herbal medicines and so forth, but some of the great legends. And you know, her faith is tied up with her view of the earth.
Aslaug's mother, Marin, is a very complicated person, and she's driven to a large degree by both her intellect and her emotional pain and physical pain. And so her behavior throughout the book is driven by those three things. She is a brilliant woman, but she's experienced such trauma in her life that she feels the need to isolate herself. She's very, very clued into the natural world, and she's also very sensitive to the way that the natural world informs many of the mythologies throughout the world. And so she teaches her daughter many of these things. But she also feels a need to isolate her daughter from the world because she's been hurt by the world.
Aslaug, the daughter, it's kind of the story of someone who's totally lost in the real ways of the world. Right. It's almost an archetypal story.
I had studied religion, as I said, in undergrad. And I was just fascinated by these repeated stories that seem to come up again and again in mythology. And I was inspired to sort of capture that in Aslaug's story. Hmm. And so she is supposed to be, in some ways, another myth.
Hmm. Elaborate on that a little bit, about the mythical properties.
Aslaug is very isolated. And so I was trying to create a person who would seem sort of timeless. And so in her voice, she's not influenced by the modern world because she hasn't been exposed to the modern world. And the way that she speaks is very much attached to the natural world. It's what she knows. And so in some ways, I wanted her to seem timeless.
She is someone who is accused of murdering her mother, and she goes to live with her aunt, who is a faith healer. And when you talk about the modern world, I mean, and faith, that is very much a part of the modern world. Is this the conflict that you're writing about?
It certainly is part of it. I was trying to create a relatively extreme situation where she would have to enter into a world that she was entirely unfamiliar with, but that would be, it would stretch her, it would strain her, it would challenge her.
Have you always been interested in the interworkings of religion and science?
I think it was fueled largely in college, but it was something that I was interested in. And I think when I came to learn that the dichotomy between science and religion is a relatively modern phenomenon, it really struck home when I learned that people like Pythagoras and Socrates didn't see science as separate from religion. In fact, they saw the natural world as a way to understand the divine. That made a lot of sense to me. I think science describes the natural laws of the world, but it can't really explain why those laws exist and operate the way they do. It's really descriptive. And I think sometimes we confuse the description with an explanation. And I think that Aslak understands that. It doesn't mean that there's not validity in that. But for her, I think it comes down to an understanding of the natural world and an understanding of the divine as being the same.
Christina Meldrum's first novel is called Mad Apple, and it's published by Knopf. She joined us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The Library of Congress chose a new poet laureate this past week. Her name? Kay Ryan. And if she were sitting in this chair right now, she'd do the whole hour in like a minute. That's how compact her poems are, how full her language is. Kay Ryan, are you ready for the job?
Yep.
And what is the job?
Well, I thought I should give you a really short answer after that intro.
That's good.
The job is deliciously general and unspecific in its nature. There are very few official duties. I have an office. I think it has pencil sharpener. Hope so. In the Library of Congress. I can make projects to improve American life and the relationship between poetry and America if I want, but I don't have to.
One of my favorites of your poems is called Home to Roost. Would you read it?
I would be glad to. Shall I tell you a little bit about that poem?
Sure.
First of all, it comes from the thing we say to other people when they've done a lot of stupid things and now they're getting their comeuppance. We say, well, your chickens are coming home to roost. And I have no doubt that when I wrote this, I was chastening myself and I was telling myself this. But unfortunately, this poem was sitting on the desk of an editor in New York at the time of 9/11. And it suddenly took on this terrible added significance. And I had to withdraw it because it seemed cruelly appropriate. I'll read it to you. The chickens are circling and blotting out the day. The sun is bright, but the chickens are in the way. Yes, the sky is dark with chickens, dense with them. They turn and then they turn again. These are the chickens you let loose, one at a time, and small, various breeds. Now they have come home to roost, all the same kind, at the same speed. Now, right after 9/11, that sounded, you know, the blue sky in here, mm-hmm. the clear sky, mm-hmm. sounded just like the beauty of that day. Mm-hmm. And those chickens sounded much too much like airplanes.
You said your poems are almost an empty suitcase.
Well, I've always been extremely enamored of cartoons and cartooning, in which you have essentially just the outline. And I think if you leave something empty but charged in some way, not overly elaborated, you can have a surprising number of things come out of people when they read it. That's what I'm hoping, anyhow. Hmm. And, I mean, the truth is, it just is my constitution to do things that way.
To keep things sparse but
powerful?
Really simple. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully.
I mean,
that would be the ideal.
But you teach remedial English at a college in Northern California, so...
Why do you say but?
Well, it just seems like a poet of your stature teaching remedial English.
Well, I think it's distinguished work. I've always taught part-time to a great extent so that I could have most of my life for wool gathering. You have to do about 100 pounds of wool gathering for an ounce of really good language.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very inefficient, and it takes an awful lot of time. But to get back to teaching remedial English, I like the relationship with students. They know what they want, and they're there to get it, as opposed to many other teaching situations.
Would you read one more poem? It's another favorite of mine called Patience.
Sure. Patience. Patience is wider than one once envisioned, with ribbons of rivers and distant ranges and tasks undertaken and finished with modest relish by natives in their native dress. Who would have guessed it possible that waiting is sustainable, a place with its own harvests, or that in time's fullness the diamonds of patience couldn't be distinguished from the genuine in brilliance or hardness?
Kay Ryan will become the nation's new poet laureate in October. Thank you very much for reading for us.
My pleasure.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.